privileged white males. Others state categorically that the walls of the locale have been irreparably breached by hip-hop and Roberto Bolaño's prose, that the popularity of the spicy tuna roll and a black American president were to white male domination what the smallpox blankets were to Native American existence. Those inclined to believe in free will and the free market argue that the lost city of white male privilege was responsible for its own demise, that the constant stream of contradictory religious and secular edicts from on high confused the highly impressionable white male, reduced him to a state of such severe social and psychic anxiety that he stopped fucking, stopped voting, stopped reading, and most importantly stopped thinking that he was the end-all be-all, or at least knew enough to pretend not to be so in public. But in any case, it became impossible to walk the streets of the lost city of white male privilege, feeding your ego by reciting mythological truisms like, "We built this country," when all around you brown men were constantly hammering and nailing, cooking world-class French meals and repairing your cars. You couldn't shout, "America, love it or leave it," when deep down inside you longed to live in Toronto, a city you told others was so cosmopolitan, by which you meant not too cosmopolitan. How could you call or think someone a nigger when your own kids, lily white and proper, called you nigger when you refused them the keys to the car? When everyday niggers were doing things that they aren't supposed to be able to do, like swimming in the Olympics and landscaping their yards. My goodness, if this nonsense keeps up, one day a nigger is going to, God forbid, direct a good movie. But not to worry. Lost city of white male privilege, real or imagined, me and Hominy had your backs, and we're proud to make you a sister city of Dickens, a.k.a. the last bastion of blackness. Too Many Mexicans. Chapter 11.
Too many Mexicans,
Charisma Molina muttered, speaking through her perfect French manicure so she wouldn't be overheard. It wasn't the first time I'd heard the racist sentiment expressed in public. Ever since the Native Americans trod up and down El Camino Real in their moccasins, seeking the source of those annoying fucking bells that rang at daybreak every Sunday morning, scaring away the bighorn sheep and ruining many a mescaline-tripping spirit walk, Californians have been cursing the Mexicans. The Indians, who were looking for peace and quiet, ended up finding Jesus, forced labor, the whip, and the rhythm method. Too many Mexicans, they'd whisper to themselves in the wheat fields and back pews when nobody was looking. White people, the type who never used to have anything to say to black people except, "We have no vacancies, you missed a spot, and rebound the basketball," finally have something to say to us. And on hot 104-degree San Fernando Valley days, when we're carrying their groceries to their cars or stuffing their mailboxes with bills, they turn and say, "Too many Mexicans," a tacit agreement between aggrieved strangers that it's neither the heat nor the humidity, but that the blame lies with our little brown brothers to the south and the north and next door and at the Grove and everywhere else in Califas. For black people, too many Mexicans is the excuse we, the historically most documented workers in history, give ourselves for attending racist rallies protesting the undocumented workers seeking better living conditions. Too many Mexicans is an oral rationalization to remain stuck in our ways. We like to dream over tea about relocating, finding better living conditions, while rifling through the real estate classifieds. What about Glendale, baby?
Too many Mexicans.
Downey?
Too many Mexicans.
Bellflower?
Too many Mexicans.
Too many Mexicans. It's a bromide for every unlicensed contractor tired of being underbid and refusing to blame their lack of employment on shoddy workmanship, nepotistic hiring practices, and a long list of shitty online references. Mexicans are to blame for everything. Someone in California sneezes, you don't say, "Gesundheit," but "Too many Mexicans." Your horse in the fifth comes up lame in the backstretch at Santa Anita. Too many Mexicans. The donkey on the button rivers a third queen at Commerce Casino. Too many Mexicans.
It's a constant California refrain. But when Charisma Molina, assistant principal of Chaff Middle School and best friend to Marpesa, my girlfriend, no matter what the fuck she says, said it, it was both the first time I'd ever heard a Mexican-American say it, and, though I didn't know it then, the first time I'd heard anyone mean it, literally. Unlike the little rascals, whenever I played hooky from school, I never went fishing, I went to school. I'd sneak out of the house while my dad had fallen asleep during blackology class and jet over to Chaff to watch the kids play hand and kickball through the chain-link fence. If I was lucky, I'd catch a glimpse of Marpesa, Charisma, and their homegirls holding court at the rear gate, sassy as a brass big band, hula-hooping their hips, chanting, ah, beep, beep, walking down the street, 10 times a week, Ngawa, Ngawa. That means black power. I'm soul sister number 9. Sock it to me one more time. For the kids at Chaff, the annual career day, held about 2 weeks before the summer break, was enough to make most of them at least contemplate career suicide before they'd even taken an aptitude test or written a resume. Held outdoors on the schoolyard blacktop, the assemblage of coal miners, driving range golf ball retrievers, basket weavers, ditch diggers, bookbinders, traumatized firefighters, and the world's last astronaut never does much to inspire. Every year it was the same old thing. We'd carry on about how indispensable and fulfilling our jobs were, but no one ever had answers for the questions from the back row. If you're so fucking important and the world can't run without you, then why are you here, boring us to tears? Why do you look so unhappy? How come there aren't any female firemen? How come nurses move so motherfucking slow? The only question ever answered to the children's satisfaction was directed to the last astronaut, an elderly black gentleman, so feeble he moved like he was experiencing weightlessness here on Earth. How do astronauts go to the bathroom? Well, I don't know about now, but in my day, they taped a plastic bag to your ass. Nobody wants to be a farmer. But about a month after Hominy's birthday celebration, Charisma asked me to do something different. We sat on my front porch, puffing gauge, while she goaded me by saying she was tired of watching the Lopez's, or the Stetson Mexicans next door, as she called them, their horses draped and saddled in glitzy vaquero finery, embarrass me year after year with their brocaded, crushed velvet cowboy suits and fancy rope tricks. Nobody cares about the subtle differences between manure and fertilizer or sustainable disease management in the butternut squash. These kids have short attention spans. You have to grab them immediately and never let go. I can't imagine anything worse than last year, when your presentation was so fucking boring, the kids threw your own organic tomatoes at you. That's why I'm not coming. I don't need the abuse. Charisma closed one eye and peered into the bowl, then handed it back to me. This shit's cashed. You want some more? Charisma nodded her head. I do, and I also want to know what the fuck this weed's called, and why does the stock market and all the shit I read in my graduate English lit seminar suddenly make sense to me? I call it perspicacity. Well, that's how good this shit is. I know what perspicacity, a word I've never heard, means. A dog barked, a cock crowed, a cow mooed, the din of the harbor freeway went E-I-E-I-O. Charisma flung back her long, straight black hair from her face and took a hit that illuminated the mysteries of the Internet, Ulysses, Gene Toomer's Kane, and the American fascination with cooking shows. She also understood how to get me to participate in Career Day. Marpesa is going to be there. I didn't need any more smoke to know that I'd never stop loving that woman. With a bank of storm clouds rolling in from the west, it looked like rain. But nothing could dissuade Charisma from making sure her students would have the benefit of discovering the tens of career opportunities available to indigent minority youth in today's America. After the garbage men, parole officers, DJs, and hype men had their say, it was time for some action. Marpesa, representing the transportation industry, who hadn't even so much as looked my way the entire day, put on a stunt-driving demonstration that would have made the Fast and Furious movie franchise proud, as she expertly slalomed her 13-ton bus between traffic cones, spun tire smoke billowing donuts over the four square courts, and after hitting a makeshift ramp constructed of lunch benches and tables, circled the schoolyard on two wheels. When the fancy driving was over, she invited the children for a tour of her bus. Loud and head-slappingly happy when they boarded, after 10 minutes or so, they filed off the bus in a quiet, orderly manner, somberly thanking Marpessa as they exited. One educator, a young white man, the sole white teacher in the school, was sobbing into his hands. After one last mournful look at the bus, he wandered away from the rest of the group and sank against the ball box, trying to get his shit together. I could never have imagined that an explanation of the transfer system and fare hikes could be so depressing. A light rain began to fall. Charisma announced it was time for the more pastoral portions of the program. Nestor Lopez was up. From Jalisco, by way of Las Cruces, the Lopezes were the first Mexican family to integrate the farms. I was about 7 when they moved in. My father used to complain about the music and all the cockfighting. The only homeschool lesson in Mexican-American history I'd ever received was, "Don't you ever fight a Mexican, because if you fight a Mexican, you have to kill a Mexican." But Nestor, even though he was 4 years older than me, and I might one day have to kill him over an unreturned Hot Wheels car or some shit, was crazy cool. On Sunday afternoons, when he came home from catechism, we'd watch charro movies and shaky videotapes of ersatz small-town rodeos. We'd drink porcelain cups of hot and cinnamony ponche his mom had made for us, and spend the rest of the afternoon recoiling from macabre videos with titles like 300 porrazos sangrientos, 101 muertes del jaripeo, 1,000 litros de sangre, and si chingas al toro, te llevas los cuernos. And yet, even though I saw most of the action through the cracks of my fingers, I've never been able to erase the images of those hard-luck cowboys riding bulls with no hands, no rodeo clowns, no medics, and no fear, as massive toros destructores bucked them into hatless, invertebrate rag dolls. We'd bellow in vicarious pain as the incredibly pointy bullhorns punctured their rhinestone shirts and aortas. High five when a fallen rider's jawbone and skull got stomped into the blood-caked dirt. In time, as black and Latin boys are wont to do, we drifted apart. Socialized victims of prison gang edicts that had nothing to do with us, but stipulated the separation of niggers and spics. Now, other than the occasional block party, I see Nestor only on career day, when to the accompaniment of the William Tell overture, he comes tearing out from behind the defunct metal shop, trick riding and bronco busting his ass off. I've never been able to figure exactly what career path Nestor represents. Show off, I suppose, but at the end of his rodeo sideshow, he doffed his ball and tasseled sombrero to the raucous applause of the crowd and stared me down with a top that sneer as he paraded past, doing a no-hand headstand in the saddle. Charisma then introduced me to a collective yawn so loud it could be heard throughout Dickens. "What's that sound? An airplane taking off?" "No, it's the nigger farmer. Must be career day at the middle school again." I led a jittery brown-eyed calf onto home plate of a baseball diamond, backstopped with a rickety chain-link fence. Some of the braver children ignored their rumbling stomachs and vitamin deficiencies to break rank and approach the animal. Cautiously, afraid they might catch a disease or fall in love, they petted the calf, speaking the syntax of the damned. "His skin's soft. Them eyes look like milk does. I wants to eat them shits." "Way this cow nigga be licking his lips, mooing and drooling and shit, remind me of your retarded mother." "Fuck you. You retarded." "All y'all retarded. Don't you know cows human too?" The irony of mispronouncing retarded, notwithstanding, I knew that I was a hit, or at least the calf was. Charisma folded her tongue between her teeth and split the air with a sharp football coach whistle. The same whistle she used to warn me and Marpessa that my father was making his way up the walkway. 200 kids quieted instantly and turned their attention deficit disorders toward me. "Hello, everybody," I said, spitting on the ground, because that's what farmers do. "Like you guys, I'm from Dickens."
"Where?"
a bunch of students shouted. I might as well have said I was from Atlantis. The children weren't from no Dickens, and they stood throwing up gang signs and telling me where they were from. Southside Jocelyn Park, Crip Gang, Barrio, 305, Bedrock Stoner Avenue Bloods. In retaliation, I tossed up the closest thing the agricultural world has to a gang sign and slid my hands across my throat, the universal sign for cut the engine, and announced, "Well, I'm from the farms, which, like all those places you've named, whether you know it or not, is in Dickens. And assistant principal Molina asked me to demonstrate what the average day for a farmer is like. And since today is this calf's 8-week anniversary, I thought I'd talk about castration. There are 3 methods of castration."
"What's castration, maestro?"
"It's a way of preventing male animals from fathering any children."
"Don't they got cow rubbers?"
"That's not a bad idea, but cows don't have hands, and like the Republican Party, any regard for females' reproductive rights. So this is a way to control the population. It also makes them more docile. Anyone know what docile means?" After passing it under her runny nose, a skinny, chalk-colored girl raised a hand so disgustingly ashy, so white and dry-skinned that it could only be black.
"It means bitch-like,"
she said, volunteering to assist me by stepping to the calf and flicking his downy ears with her fingers.
"Yeah, I guess you could say that it does."
And either the mention of bitch or the misguided notion they were going to learn something about sex, the children closed in and tightened the circle. The ones who weren't in the first 2 rows were ducking and scooting around for better vantage points. A few kids climbed to the top of the backstop's rafters and peered down on the procedure like med students in an operating theater. I body-slammed the calf on its side and kneeled down on his neck and ribcage, then directed my unlotioned cow hands to grab and spread his hind legs until the little doggie's genitals were exposed to the elements. Seeing that I had their attention, I noticed Charisma checking on her still whimpering employee, then tiptoeing back aboard Marpessa's bus. "As I was saying, there are 3 methods of castration. Surgical, elastic, and bloodless. In elastic, you place a rubber band right here, preventing any blood flow going to the testicles. That way they'll eventually shrivel up and fall off." I grabbed the animal at the base of his scrotum and squeezed so hard the calf and the school children jumped in unison. "For bloodless castration, you crush the spermatic cords here and here." 2 firm pinches of his vast deference glance sent the calf into whimpering convulsions of pain and embarrassment, and the students into spasms of sadistic laughter. I whipped out a jackknife and held it up high, twisting my hand in the air, expecting the blade to glint dramatically in the sunlight, but it was too cloudy. "For surgery, I want to do it." It was the little black girl, her clear brown eyes fixed on the calf's scrotum and bulging with scientific curiosity. "I think you need a permission slip from your parents."
"What parents?"
"I live at El Nido," she said, referring to the group home on Wilmington, which in the neighborhood was tantamount to name-dropping Sing Sing in a James Cagney movie. "What's your name?"
"Sheila. Sheila Clark."
Sheila and I changed places, clamoring over and under one another without taking any weight off the hapless calf. When I got to the back end, I handed her the knife and the emasculator, which, like the garden shears they resembled, and any other good tool, does exactly what its name says it's going to do. Two pints of blood, a surprisingly deft removal of the top half of the scrotum, an artful yank of the testes into the open air, an audible crunching, severing of the spermatic cord, a schoolyard full of shrieking pupils, teachers, and one permanently sexually frustrated calf later, I was finishing up my lecture for the benefit of Sheila Clark and three other grade schoolers intrigued enough to wade into the spreading pool of blood to get a better look at the wound while I wrestled with the still squirming calf. When the bull is lying here helpless on his side, we in the farming industry like to call this the recumbent position. And now isn't a bad time to inflict other painful procedures on the animal, like dehorning, vaccinations, branding, and marking the ears. The rain fell harder. The drops, big and warm, kicked up small clouds of dust as they pelted the hard, dry pavement. In the middle of the schoolyard, the janitorial staff was hurriedly unloading a dumpster. They tossed the broken wooden desks, cracked blackboards, and shards of a termite-ridden handball wall into a big pile, then stuffed the crevices with newspaper. Normally, career day ended with a giant marshmallow roast. The skies were getting even darker. I had the feeling the kids would be disappointed. In the growing wetness, the teacher, save for the crybaby staring into the flat basketball as if his world had come to an end, and other careerists tried to round up the kids, snatching them off the broken-down swings, rusted-out monkey bar and jungle gym sets, while Nestor galloped around the frightened herd, steering them away from the gates. Marpessa had started the bus, and Charisma climbed out just as the calf started to recover from the shock. I looked for my assistant, Sheila Clark, but she was too busy holding up the pair of bloody testicles by their stringy entrails, dangling them in the air and slamming them into one another like a pair of 25-cent vending machine clacker balls to be of any use. As I slipped the animal into a headlock, turning on my back and digging my boot heels into his crotch to keep him from kicking me in the face, Marpessa U-turned the bus around and headed out the side gate and onto Shenandoah Street without so much as a goodbye wave. Fuck her. Charisma stood over me, smiling, reading the hurt in my eyes.
You two were so meant for each other.
Do me a favor. In my bag, there's some antiseptic and a little jar of goop that says Fliegenschutz. Assistant Principal Melina did what she's always done since she was a little girl. She got her hands dirty, spraying the writhing animal with disinfectant and slathering on the sticky Fliegenschutz over the gaping wound where his testicles used to be. When she finished, the white teacher, his face streaked with tears, tapped his boss on the shoulder, and like a television cop handing in his badge and gun, he solemnly removed the shiny new Teach for America button fastened to his sweater vest, placed it in Charisma's palm, and walked off into the squall. What was that about?
When we were on the bus, your skinny farmhand Sheila here stood up, pointed to the priority seating for white sign, and told young Mr. Edmonds he could have her seat. And that idiot takes her up on the offer, sits down, realizes what he's done, and fucking loses it.
Wait, the signs are still up?
You don't know?
Know what?
You talk a lot of shit about the hood, but you don't know what's going on in the hood? Ever since you put those signs up, Marpessa's bus has been the safest place in the city. She forgotten all about them, too, until her shift supervisor pointed out she hadn't had an incident report since Hominy's birthday party. But then she started thinking about it, how people were treating each other with respect, saying hello when they got on, thank you when they got off. There was no gang fighting, Crip, Blood, or Cholo. They pressed the stop request button one time and one fucking time only. You know where the kids go do their homework? Not home, not the library, but the bus. That's how safe it is.
Crime is cyclical.
It's the signs. People grouse at first, but the racism takes them back, makes them humble, makes them realize how far we've come and, more important, how far we have to go. On that bus, it's like the specter of segregation has brought Dickens together.
What about that crybaby teacher?
Mr. Edmonds is a good math specialist, but obviously he can't teach the kids anything about themselves, so fuck him.
More or less healed, the calf scrambled to its feet. Sheila, his little emasculator, leaned teasingly in his face, holding his testes from her earlobes like costume jewelry. One last goodbye sniff of his manhood, and he ambled off to commiserate with the ballless tetherpole balls that stood bent and useless next to the cafeteria. Charisma rubbed her tired eyes.
Now, if I get these little motherfuckers to behave in school like they do on the bus, we'd be on to something.
Led by Nestor Lopez, who was 10 lengths ahead of the pack, galloping in for his reward money, Sheila's classmates were being shepherded over the concrete plains, marched through the drizzle and past the rows of thatched, tar-paper-roofed bungalows, windows glassed with newsprint and colored construction paper. Buildings in such disrepair, they made the one-room African schoolhouses on late-night television fundraisers damn near look like college lecture halls in comparison. It was a modern-day trail of tears. The kids were circled around the mound of broken school furniture, their excitement undeterred despite the crackle of the raindrops on the giant bags of marshmallows and the steadily darkening pile of wood and damp newsprint. Behind them was the school's auditorium, the roof of which had collapsed in the Northridge quake of 94 and had never been rebuilt. Charisma ran her hand down the length of Nestor's Rose Parade saddlebells. The jingle jangle made the kids smile. Just then, Sheila Clark, tearfully rubbing her shoulder, ran up.
"Miss Molina, that white boy stole one of my balls,"
she wailed, pointing at the chubby Latino kid, 3 shades darker than her, vainly trying to superball the testis against the wet ground. Charisma gently stroked Sheila's braided head, soothing her feelings. "That was a new one on me. Black kids referring to their Latino peers as white." When I was their age, back when we used to scream, "Not it," before games of kick the can and red light, green light, back before the violence, the poverty, and the infighting had reduced our indigenous land rights from all of Dickens to isolated city blocks of gang turf, everyone in Dickens, regardless of race, was black, and you determined someone's degree of blackness not by skin color or hair texture, but by whether they said, "For all intents and purposes," or "For all intensive purposes." Marpessa used to say that despite the fall of straight black hair that cascaded down to her butt and her horchata complexion, she didn't know Charisma wasn't black until the day Charisma's mother stopped by to pick her up from school. Her walk and talk, so different from her daughter's. Stunned, she turned to her best friend.
"You Mexican?"
Thinking her homegirl was tripping, Charisma blanched, about to exclaim,
"I ain't Mexican,"
when, as if seeing her for the first time, she took a good look at her own mother in the after-school context of the surrounding black faces and rhythms, and was like,
"Oh, fuck, I am Mexican. Hijo de puta."
That was a long time ago. Before lighting the bonfire, Assistant Principal Molina addressed her troops. It was obvious in the seriousness in her face and the tone of her voice that she was a general at the end of her rope. Resigned to the fate that the black and brown troops she was sending out into the world didn't have much of a chance.
"Cada día de carreras profesionales, yo pienso la misma cosa. De estos 250 niños, ¿cuántos terminarán la escuela secundaria? 40%? Órale, y de esos 100 con suerte, ¿cuántos irán a la universidad? Online, junior, clown college, o lo que sea. About 5, más o menos. ¿Y cuántos graduarán? 2, maybe. ¡Qué lástima! Estamos chingados."
And although, like most black males raised in Los Angeles, I'm bilingual only to the extent that I can sexually harass women of all ethnicities in their native languages, I understood the gist of the message. Those kids were fucked. I was surprised how many of the children carried lighters, but no matter how many attempts were made to start the bonfire, the water-soaked wood wouldn't catch. Charisma ordered a group of students to the storage shed. They returned bearing cardboard boxes, the contents of which they dumped on the ground. Soon there was a pyramid of books about 5 feet wide and 3 feet high and rising. "Well, what the fuck are you waiting for?" She didn't have to ask twice. The books caught like kindling, and the flames of a good-sized bonfire licked the sky as the students happily roasted marshmallows on number two pencils. I pulled Charisma aside. I couldn't believe she was burning books. I thought school supplies were in short supply. Those aren't books. Those came from Foy Cheshire. He has a whole curriculum called Fire the Cannon, featuring such rewritten classics as Uncle Tom's Condo and The Point Guard in the Rye that he's pushing on the school board. Look, we've tried everything. Smaller classrooms, longer hours, bilingual, monolingual, and sublingual educations, ebonics, phonics, and hypnotics, color schemes designed to promote the optimum learning environment. But no matter what warm to medium cool hues you paint the walls, when it all comes down to it, it's white teachers talking white methodology and drinking white wine and some wannabe white administrator threatening to put your school into receivership because he knows Foy Cheshire. Nothing works, but I'll be damned if the Chaff Middle School will hand out the copies of The Dope Man Cometh to its students. I kicked a partially burned tome away from the fire. The cover was charred, but still readable. The Great Blacksby, page one of which was Real Talk. When I was young, dumb, and full of cum, my omnipresent, good to my mother, non-stereotypical African-American daddy dropped some knowledge on me that I've been tripping off of ever since. Using my lighter, I finished torching the book myself and held its flaming pages under the marshmallow on a wooden ruler that Sheila had kindly offered me. She had fashioned a leash from a jump rope and was stroking the calf on the head. While the Latino was trying to surgically reattach his testicles with Elmer's glue and a paperclip, until Charisma grabbed him by the neck and stood him up. "You kids have a good career day?" "I want to be a veterinarian," Sheila answered.
"That's gay,"
countered her Latino nemesis, who was juggling the gonads with one hand.
"Juggling is gay. Calling people gay who call you gay just because you call them gay is gay."
"Okay, that's enough," Charisma scolded. "My God, is there anything you kids don't think is gay?" The fat boy thought for a long moment.
"You know what's not gay? Being gay."
Laughing through her tears, Charisma collapsed on a beige fiberglass bench as the 3 o'clock bell rang. It had been a long day. I sidled in next to her. The clouds finally caved in, and the drizzle turned into a steady downpour. The students and faculty ran to their cars, the bus stop, and the waiting arms of their parents, while we sat there in the shower like good Southern Californians, umbrella-less, and listening to the raindrops sizzle in the slowly dying fire. "Charisma, I thought of a way to get the kids to behave and respect each other like they do on the bus."
"How?"
"Segregate the school." As soon as I said it, I realized that segregation would be the key to bringing Dickens back. The communal feeling of the bus would spread to the school and then permeate the rest of the city. Apartheid united black South Africa. Why couldn't it do the same for Dickens?
"By race? You want to segregate the school by color?"
Charisma looked at me like I was one of her students. Not stupid, but clueless. But if you ask me, Chaff Middle School had already been segregated and resegregated many times over. Maybe not by color, but certainly by reading level and behavior problem. The English as a second language speakers were on a different learning track than the English when and only if I feel like it speakers. During Black History Month, My father used to watch the nightly television footage of the freedom buses burning, the dogs snarling and snapping, and say to me, "You can't force integration, boy. The people who want to integrate will integrate." I've never figured out to what extent, if at all, I agree or disagree with them, but it's an observation that stayed with me. Made me realize that for many people, integration is a finite concept. Here in America, integration can be a cover-up. I'm not racist. My prom date, second cousin, my president is black, or whatever. The problem is that we don't know whether integration is a natural or unnatural state. Is integration, forced or otherwise, social entropy or social order? No one's ever defined the concept. Charisma was giving segregation some thought, though, as she slowly rotated the last of the marshmallows in the flame. I knew what she was thinking. She was thinking about how her middle school alma mater was now 75% Latino, when in her day it was 80% black. Thinking about listening to her mother, Sally Molina, tell stories about growing up in segregated small-town Arizona in the 1940s and 50s, having to sit on the hot side of the church, the farthest away from Jesus and the fire exits, having to go to the Mexican schools and bury her parents and her baby brother at the Mexican cemetery outside of town on Highway 60. How when the family moved to Los Angeles in 1954, the racial discrimination was more or less the same. Except that unlike the black Angelenos, they could at least use the public beaches.
You want to segregate the school by race?
Yeah.
If you think you can do it, go ahead.
But I'm telling you, there's too many Mexicans. I can't speak for the children, but driving home, the newly castrated calf in the front seat of the pickup, his head out the window catching raindrops on his tongue, I left career day as inspired as I'd ever been and with renewed focus. What was it, Charisma said?
It's like the specter of segregation has brought the city of Dickens back together again.
I decided to give my new career as city planner in charge of restoration and segregation another 6 months. If things didn't work out, I could always fall back on being black.
Chapter 12. It rained buckets that summer after career day. The white boys at the beach called it bummer, as in the bummer of 42. The weather reports were nothing but nonstop references to record rainfall and continuous cloud cover. Every day at around 9:30, a low-pressure system settled over the coastline, and it'd pour off and on until early evening. Some folks won't surf in the rain. Even more refuse to go out after a storm, worried about contracting hepatitis from the sludge and all the polluted runoff that flows into the Pacific after a heavy downpour. Personally, I like catching waves in the rain. Fewer fuckers in the lineup, no windsurfers. Stay away from the arroyos near Malibu and Rincon, which tend to overflow with septic waste, and you'll be fine. So that summer, I didn't worry about fecal matter and microbes. I agonized over my satsumas and segregation. How do you grow the world's most water-sensitive citrus tree under monsoon conditions? How do you racially segregate an already segregated school? Hominy, the race reactionary, was no help. He loved the idea of bringing back segregated education because he thought the idea would make Dickens more attractive to white resettlement, that the city would return to being the thriving white suburb of his youth. Cars with tail fins, straw hats and sock hops, Episcopalians and ice cream socials. It would be the opposite of white flight, he said.
The Ku Klux influx.
But when I'd ask him how, he'd just shrug, and like a conservative senator without any ideas, filibuster me with unrelated stories about the good old days.
Once, in an episode called Pop Quizzling, Stymie tried to avoid taking a history test he hadn't studied for by setting his desk on fire. But of course he ended up burning down the entire school, and the gang had to take the test on top of a fire truck, 'cause Miss Crabtree didn't play that shit.
Then there was the guilt that comes along with being a segregationist. I stayed up nights trying to convince Funshine Bear, whose fur over the years had mottled and turned from sunray yellow to toe jam brown, that the reintroduction of segregation would be a good thing. That like Paris has the Eiffel Tower, St. Louis the Arch, and New York an insanely huge income disparity, Dickens would have segregated schools. If nothing else, the Chamber of Commerce brochure would look attractive. Welcome to the glorious city of Dickens, the urban paradise on the banks of the Los Angeles River, home to roving bands of youth groups, a retired movie star, and segregated schools. Lots of people claim to get their best ideas in water. The shower, floating in the pool, waiting for a wave. Something about negative ions, white noise, and being in isolation. So you'd think that surfing in the rain would be the equivalent of a one-man brainstorm, but not me. I get my good ideas not while surfing, but while driving home from surfing. So sitting in traffic after a nice rainy day July session, reeking of sewage and seaweed, I watched the remedial rich kids pour out of summer school at Intersection Academy, a prestigious oceanfront private learning fulcrum. As they crossed the street to their waiting limousines and luxury cars, they'd flash me hang loose and gang signs, stick their shaggy heads into my cab and say, "Bro, you got any weed? Hang 10, African-American wave rider." Despite the steady downpour, the students never seemed to get wet, mostly because valets and scullery maids chased after their rambunctious wards, holding umbrellas over their heads. But some kids were just too white to get wet. Try to imagine Winston Churchill, Colin Powell, and Condoleezza Rice, or the Lone Ranger soaked from head to toe, and you'll get the idea. For a hot second, when I was 8, Pops flirted with enrolling my intellectually lazy ass in a fancy prep school. He stood over me while I was shin-deep in the rice paddy, planting stalks into the mud. He muttered something about choosing between Jews in Santa Monica and Gentiles in Holmby Hills, then began citing research that black kids who go to school with white kids of any religion do better, while also positing some not-so-credible research that black people were better off during segregation. I don't remember his definition of better off or why I didn't go to Interchange or Haverford Meadowbrook. The commute, maybe? Too expensive? But watching those kids, the sons and daughters of music and movie industry moguls, file out of that state-of-the-art building, it dawned on me that, as the sole student of Daddy's K-through-forever homeschool, I had been the beneficiary of a most segregated education, one with thankfully little exposure to infinity pools, homemade foie gras, and American ballet. And while I was no closer to figuring out how to save my Satsuma crop, I did have an idea how to racially segregate what, for all intents and purposes and Latinos, was an all-black school. I drove home, my father's voice swimming in my head. When I got back home, Hominy was waiting for me out in the yard, standing under a large green and white golf umbrella, his bare feet making a deep hammer-toed impression in the wet grass. Ever since I'd agreed to segregate the middle school, he'd become a much better worker. He was no fucking John Henry by any stretch, but if he took an interest in something on the farm, he'd at least show some self-initiative. Lately, he'd been very protective of the Satsuma tree. Sometimes he'd stand next to it for hours, shooing away birds and bugs. The Satsumas reminded him of the camaraderie of studio life, thumb wrestling with Weezer, slapping Fatty Arbuckle upside the head, truth or dare games where the loser would have to streak through the Laurel and Hardy set. It was during a long break between shots on I See Paris, I See France that Hominy discovered the Satsuma Mandarin. Most of the gang had gathered around the craft services table, downing cupcakes and cream soda. But there were some southern theater owners on the set that day, and the studio, wanting to make nice with a cast system that refused to show their movies because they featured colored and white kids playing together, asked Hominy and Buckwheat to eat with some Japanese extras who, during the immigration roundup of 36, had been drafted to play Mexican bandits. The extras offered them some non-union soba noodles and satsumas imported from the land of the rising sun.
The black boys found the fruit's perfectly balanced bittersweet flavor to be the only thing that removed the nasty taste of comic relief watermelon from their mouths. Eventually, he and Buckwheat had riders put in their contracts. Only satsumas were allowed on set. No clementines, tangerines, or tangelos. Because nothing restored one's dignity like a sweet, juicy satsuma orange after a hard day of cooning. Hominy still thinks I tend the tree to suit his needs. He doesn't know that I planted it the same day me and Marpesa officially split. I'd finished freshman year midterms and driven home, flying west on CA-91, spurred on by what I thought would be the awaiting congratulatory fuck, and not a note pinned through the sow's ear that simply read, "Nah, nigga." He pulled desperately on the sleeve of my wetsuit. "Massa, you told me to tell you when the satsumas were the size of ping-pong balls." Like a golf caddy who refuses to give up on an employer's woeful round, Hominy held the umbrella over my head, handed me the refractometer, and urged me into the backyard where we tramped through the mud to the waterlogged tree. "Please, massa, hurry. I don't think they're gonna make it." Most citrus fruits require frequent watering, but the inverse is true for satsumas. They turn water into piss, and no matter how much pruning I did, that year's crop hung heavy and mean on the branches. If I couldn't figure out a way to decrease the water intake, the yield would be shit, and I'd have wasted 10 years and 50 pounds of imported Japanese fertilizer. I clipped a mandarin off the nearest tree. Snipping it a quarter inch above the navel, I dug my thumb into the bumpy flesh, ripping it open and squeezing a few drops into the refractometer, the small, overpriced Japanese-made machine that measures the percentage of sucrose in the juice.
"What's it say?"
he asked desperately.
2.3. "What's that on the sweetness scale?"
"Somewhere between Ava Braun and a South African salt mine." I never nigger whispered to my plants. I don't believe that plants are sentient beings, but after Hominy went home, I talked to those trees for an hour, read them poetry, and sang them the blues.
Chapter 13.
I've experienced direct discrimination based on race only once in my life. One day I foolishly said to my father that there was no racism in America, only equal opportunity that black people kick aside because we don't want to take responsibility for ourselves. Later that very same day, in the middle of the night, he snatched me up out of bed, and together we took an ill-prepared cross-country trip into deepest, whitest America. After 3 days of nonstop driving, we ended up in a nameless Mississippi town that was nothing more than a dusty intersection of searing heat, crows, cotton fields, and judging by the excited look of anticipation on my father's face, unadulterated racism.
"There it is," he said,
pointing toward a run-down general store so out of date the pinball machine blinking happily in the window took only dimes and displayed a mind-numbing high current score of 5,637. I looked around for the racism. Out front, three burly white men with those sun-baked crow's foot visages that make age an indeterminate number sat on wooden Coca-Cola crates, loudly talking shit about an upcoming stock car race. We pulled into the gas station across the street. A bell rang, startling both the black attendant and me. Reluctantly, he broke away from the video chess game he was playing with a friend on the television.
"Fill her up, please."
"Sure thing. Check the oil."
My father nodded, never taking his eyes off the store. The attendant, Clyde, if the name fancily stitched in red cursive on the white patch on his blue coveralls was to be trusted, jumped to his duties. He checked the oil, the tire pressure, and slid his grease rag over the front and back windshields. I don't think I'd ever seen service with a smile before. And whatever was in that spray bottle, the windows had never been so clean. When the tank was full, my father asked Clyde,
"You think me and the boy could sit here, Mike?"
"Sure, go ahead."
"A mite?" I hung my head in embarrassment. I hate when people get all folksy around black people they think they're superior to,
What was next? Fixing? Show enough? A chorus of Who Let the Dogs Out?
Dad, what are we doing here?
I mumbled, my mouth full of the saltine crackers I'd been stuffing down my gullet since Memphis. Anything to take my mind off the heat, the endless cotton fields, and the thought of how bad slavery must have been for someone to convince themselves that Canada wasn't that far away. Although he never spoke about it, like his runaway ancestors, my father, too, fled to Canada, dodging the draft and the Vietnam War. If black people ever do get slave reparations, I know plenty of motherfuckers who owe Canada some rent money and back taxes.
Dad, what are we doing here?
We're reckless eyeballing, he said, removing a pair of 500X General Patton binoculars from a fancy leather case, placing the black metal monstrosities to his eyes and turning toward me, his eyes big as billiard balls through the thick lenses. And I do mean reckless.
Thanks to years of my father's black vernacular pop quizzes and an Ishmael Reed book he kept on top of the toilet for years, I knew that reckless eyeballing was the act of a black male deigning to look at a southern white female. And there was my dad staring through his binoculars at a storefront no more than 30 feet away, the Mississippi sun glinting off the massive spectacles like two halogen beacons. A woman stepped out onto the porch, an apron tied around her gingham dress, a wicker broom in her hand. Shielding her eyes from the glare, she began to sweep.
The white men sat open-legged and open-mouthed, aghast at the sheer fucking nigger audacity. "Look at those tits!" my father shouted, loud enough for the entire Cracker County to hear. Her chest wasn't all that, but I imagine that through the portable equivalent of the Hubble Space Telescope, her B-cup breasts looked like the Hindenburg and the Goodyear blimp, respectively. "Now, boy, now!"
"Now what?"
"Go out there and whistle at the white woman."
He shoved me out the door, and kicking up a blinding cloud of red Delta dust, I crossed a 2-lane highway covered with so much rock-hard clay I couldn't tell if the road had ever been paved. Obligingly, I stood in front of the white lady and began to whistle, or at least tried to. What my father didn't know is that I didn't know how to whistle. Whistling is one of the few things you learn at public school. I was homeschooled, so my lunch hours were spent standing in the backyard cotton patch reciting all the Negro Reconstruction congressmen from memory. Blanche Bruce, Hiram Rhodes, John R. Lynch, Josiah T. Walls. So, although it sounds simple, I didn't know how to just put my lips together and blow. And for that matter, I can't split my fingers into the Vulcan high sign, burp the alphabet on command, or flip someone the bird without folding down the non-insulting fingers with my free hand. Having a mouthful of crackers didn't help either, and the end result was an arrhythmic spewing of pre-chewed oats all over her pretty pink apron.
"What's this crazy fool doing?"
the white men asked each other between eye rolls and tobacco expectorations. The most taciturn member of the trio stood up and straightened out his No Niggers in NASCAR t-shirt. Slowly removing the toothpick from his mouth, he said,
"It's the bolero. The little nigger is whistling bolero."
I jumped up and down and pumped his hand in excitement. He was right, of course. I was trying to recreate Ravel's masterpiece. I may not know how to whistle, but I could always carry a tune.
"The bolero? Why, you stupid motherfucker." It was Pops, storming out from the car and moving so fast his dust cloud kicked up its own dust cloud. He wasn't happy, because apparently not only did I not know how to whistle, I didn't know what to whistle. "You're supposed to wolf whistle, like this."
Recklessly eyeballing her the whole way, he pursed his lips and let go a wolf whistle so lecherous and libidinous it curled both the white woman's pretty painted toes and the dainty red ribbon in her blonde hair. Now it was her turn, and my father stood there, lustful and black, as she just as defiantly not only recklessly eyeballed him back, but recklessly rubbed his dick through his pants.
kneading his crotch like pizza dough for all she was worth. Dad quickly whispered something in her ear, handed me a $5 bill, said, "I'll be back," and together they hurried into the car and tore out down some dirt road, leaving me to be lynched for his crimes.
Is there a black buck Rebecca ain't fucked from here to Natchez?
Well, least she knows what she likes. Your dumb Peckerwood ass still ain't decided whether you like men or not.
I'm bisexual. I likes both.
Ain't no such thing. You either is or you ain't. Man crush on Dale Earnhardt my ass.
While the good old boys argued the merits and manifestations of sexuality, I, thankful to be alive, went inside the store for a soda. They carried only one brand and one size, Coca-Cola, in the classic 7-ounce bottle. I twisted one open and watched the effervescent sprites of carbon dioxide dance in the sun rays. I can't tell you how good that Coke tasted, but there's an old joke that I never understood until that bubbling brown elixir slid soothingly down my throat. Bubba the Redneck, a nigger, and a Mexican are sitting at the same bus stop when, bam, a genie appears out of nowhere in a cloud of smoke.
"You each get one wish," says the genie, adjusting his turban and his ruby rings.
So the nigger says, "I wish for all my black brothers and sisters to be in Africa, where the land will nourish us and all Africans can prosper." The genie waved his hands, and bam, all the blacks left America and went to Africa. The Mexican then said,
"Órale, that sounds good to me. I want all my Mexican people to be in Mexico, where we can live well and have jobs and drink from glorious pools of tequila."
Bam! They all went to Mexico and left America. Then the genie turns to Bubba the Redneck and says,
"And what is it you desire, Sahib? Your wish is my command."
Bubba looks at the genie and says,
"So, you're telling me that all the Mexicans are in Mexico and all the niggers are in Africa?"
"Yes, Sahib."
"Well, it's kind of hot today. I guess I'll have a Coke."
That's how good that Coke was.
"That'll cost 7 cents. Just leave it on the counter, boy. Your new mommy be back in no time."
10 sodas and 70 cents later, neither my new mother nor my old father had returned, and I had to take a wicked piss. The fellows at the gas station were still playing chess, the attendant's cursor hovering hesitatingly over a cornered piece as if his next decision decided the fate of the world. The attendant slammed a knight onto a square.
"You ain't fooling nobody with that Sicilian gambit chicanery. Your diagonals is vulnerable as shit."
My bladder about to burst, I asked Black Kasparov where the bathroom was located.
"Restrooms are for customers only."
"But my dad just purchased some gas—"
"And your father can shit here until his heart's content. You, on the other hand, are drinking the white man's coke like his ice is colder than ours."
I pointed to the row of 7-ounce sodas in the cooler.
"How much?"
$1.50.
"But there's 7 cents across the street."
"Buy black or piss off. Literally."
Feeling sorry for me, and winning on points, Black Bobby Fisher pointed into the distance at an old bus station.
"See that abandoned bus station next to the cotton gin?"
I sprinted down the road. Although the building was no longer operational, balls of cottonseed still blew in the wind like itchy snowflakes. I made my way to the back, past the gin, the empty pallets, a rusted forklift, and the ghost of Eli Whitney. The filthy one-toilet bathroom buzzed with flies. The floors and the seat were flypaper sticky, glazed to a dull matte yellow by 4 generations of good old boys with bottomless bladders, pissing countless gallons of drunk-on-the-job clear urine. The acrid stink of unflushed racism and shit shriveled my face and put goosebumps on my arms. Slowly, I backed out. Underneath the faded whites only stenciled on the grimy lavatory door, I ran my finger through the grit and wrote, "Thank God," then peed on an anthill.
because apparently the rest of the planet was colored only.
Chapter 14.